Hello, it's Thursday 1st of April. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On this week's show, Gary Bowerman of Checking Asia and I will be talking all things aviation with Dirk Singer, Research Director of Simplifying, Director of the Harmony Agency and Managing Editor of the Aviation Marketing Monthly. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today, we're excited to welcome Dirk Singer, Research Director of Simplifying and Aviation Expert. Dirk, it's great to welcome you to the Southeast Asia Travel Show. How are you today, and where are you?
I am in lockdown London, though obviously we're sort of hopefully nearing the end of it. And I am good. I haven't traveled in a while, but I'm hoping to sort of to do so, you know, at some point in 2021.
Haven't traveled in a while. Can you remember your last flight?
I can. It was, I didn't travel at all in 2020. The last time I traveled was at the end of 2019. I went to Canada. I was due to go in March 2020. I was meant to have two trips, one to the annual South by Southwest Festival I go to every year in Austin, Texas, and one to Portugal. And both of those were canceled because, of course, that's just the time that it hit. In fact, I remember that sort of that South by Southwest was cancelled round about the sort of the 5th of March or so. And then obviously then things very, very quickly took a sort of a downward turn after that. And I was, I have family in Germany and I was thinking of sort of going there during the summer and the autumn. But one of the things that was kept me back, so to speak, was the uncertainty over the rules changing very, very quickly. And it's one of the things that we'll talk about. But of course, you know, one of the main disincentives to people traveling is being stuck somewhere and then not knowing if things are going to change, when you come back home.
We're eager to get into talking about some of the work that Simplifying has been doing over recent months, because Hannah and I, we are actually big fans and we've been reading everything. But firstly, let's talk a little bit about yourself, Dirk. You're a history and law graduate, I think, when you've worked in the creative, the media and the communications field, and now you're in aviation and travel industry research. So was that kind of a defined career path?
Yes and no. I mean, sort of. I mean, I went to Edinburgh University and did a history degree. And in Scotland, it's quite easy to tack a law degree at the end of it. And you do it like an accelerated period of 2 years. Fairly quickly into that degree, I realized that, becoming a lawyer was not for me. And I started doing work experience jobs at the Edinburgh Festival and other places in the press offices. And that's where I got into the PR industry. And I worked for various PR consultancies for about 20 years. You know, I started two agencies here in London, both of which made it to Agency of the Year. So I wasn't sort of in PR and social media and digital media. And about sort of 7-8 years ago, the agency that I was with, we acquired two travel and aviation clients. One was London Gatwick Airport. The other one was British Midland International, which is obviously, BMI doesn't exist anymore, but it did then. And that's how I fell into the whole, aviation space. So I started doing aviation PR and aviation social media. I knew of Simply Flying. Actually, Gatwick won a number of awards, Simply Flying awards. I started working with them part-time. I edited one of their magazines. A year ago, back in March, things sort of really took a turn in my career and a lot of other people's careers as well. And that, marketing consulting work for aviation clients was not really happening anymore. And the magazine which I was editing, which was all about, aviation marketing, was sort of redundant too. So, I and also many of my colleagues, we quickly sort of pivoted across into trying to find solutions for the aviation industry of how we get through this, and that's sort of been my journey over the past 1 year and also before that time as well.
You mentioned that you've been director of a PR agency. Now the interesting thing is the role of the media in this tourism industry, that issues that we've had over the last year. I mean, how do you think the media has actually covered this? And what part can the media play in the recovery that we're all hoping for?
Yeah, I mean, I would really point to two issues in which travel during the pandemic is being portrayed right now. First of all, is that whenever, there are the inevitable cases of people getting through, you know, from one destination to the next, and having COVID, you know, then that gets a lot of media coverage and a lot of media publicity. And you sometimes wonder whether, you know, I mean, and there have been obviously some quite bad cases, obviously, like on flights from, you know, from Pakistan to Dubai to Hong Kong. There's a very well-known case, you know, sort of last year when there were, I think, 31 COVID positive passengers arrived in Hong Kong. And things like that rightfully get a lot of coverage. But then also you have cases where, you know, like one or two COVID positive passengers appearing at their destination, it sort of is blown out of a lot of proportion and it gets a disproportionate amount of media coverage. That I think is the first point. The second point I would make is that the debate is being portrayed very much about people wanting to go on holiday, wanting to go on vacation. And of course, travel is about much more than that. You know, it's about, obviously about business, but it's also about family reunions. And I think that the, you know, the media focus, even though I understand why it's happening, on, you know, people want to go away for, you know, into the sun, is unhelpful, because it portrays travel as being quite a selfish thing, when, you know, when travel happens for all sorts of reasons. And yes, people go on vacation, but yes, you know, it's important for, you know, for lots of other reasons as well.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the things we've said on the podcast several times, particularly here in Southeast Asia, is I think, to be honest, a lot of governments have actually learned a lot about the difference between travel and tourism over the last year. You know, in our region, particularly, as you mentioned, you know, there's a lot of business travel, there's a lot of leisure travel, but there's also travel for migration purposes, for working overseas, for seeing family and friends. Also, education is such an important reason for people to travel in this region as well. So, yeah, I think, you know, you kind of feel that governments didn't quite understand the nuances of the travel sector before this actually happened. So tell us a little bit about Simplifying, Dirk. We've been reading a lot of the reports that you put out in your daily newsletter. But tell us a little bit about how the company started and what its objectives are.
Yeah, so Simplifying was started over 10 years ago by Shashank Nigam, who is actually from Singapore, by the way, even though he's now living in Canada. And it started off, and for the first, you know, so 10, 11 years, was a business that was mainly focused on marketing consulting projects for aviation brands. And Simplifying's worked for, you know, over 100 airlines and airports over the past decade. As I sort of mentioned, when the pandemic hit in March and April, the business had to change very, very quickly, because obviously in this space, marketing spend and consulting projects are the first thing that's cut whenever, you know, an economic downturn hits. And we moved towards, you know, trying to find solutions, you know, for the industry during the pandemic. So Simplifying today looks very, very different to how it did sort of a year two years ago. And one of the first things that we did was we launched a number of research reports, all about how the airport check-in experience and the experience of flying would be very, very different post pandemic to how it was, you know, in 2017, 2018, 2019. And we released that last April, May. So, you know, so fairly early on. We then started up an accelerator called the Simplifying Launchpad, which was there to match startups who had solutions and technology. So for example, you know, UV cleaning robots, or various testing solutions, and also, you know, digital passport apps, with airport and airline partners. And then the final thing that we've moved on to is we've created a brand called Fit to Fly. And Fit to Fly is a testing portal that we build for airlines and airports, where we onboard labs in various countries. Mexico is actually the first country that we're working in. We partner with airlines. In this case, we're working with Volaris, which is obviously the largest Mexican low fares airline. And it is it's an airline branded portal where passengers can book tests before, in this case, before they travel to the United States. So, you know, so what we're doing now and what I'm doing now is certainly not what I would have imagined, you know, I would have been doing, you know, 12 months ago. When things like PCR or antigen tests meant nothing to me.
Yeah, right. So let's break this down into, the simple big question, really, that everybody is asking, and it's quite a difficult one to actually answer. What is it that's holding back air travel right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look sort of at three different layers of severity. I mean, you have, you know, you have outright travel bans, you have quarantine, and you have uncertainty and different steps. Now, the outright travel bans are, I mean, I'm here in the in the UK. And as you know, I could get fined £5,000 for going on holiday. I can only leave the country if I have, a predefined list of reasons from, from obviously emergency family reasons to essential business. But holidays are out on pain of a fine. So that's obviously very, very clear. I can't actually leave. Secondly is quarantine. Quarantine kills travel. If we take the Seychelles, for example, the Seychelles has now managed to, vaccinate, 70-75% of its population, thanks partially due to a donation of the Sinopharm vaccine from the United Arab Emirates. And as a result of that, the Seychelles is allowing tourists to come in without a, without having to quarantine. That's great. But of course, for something like that to happen, you have to have no quarantine on both ends. Leaving aside the fact that I could get fined for going on holiday to the Seychelles anyway, the UK counts the Seychelles as a red country, which means that, that were I to come back, I would then have to pay, £1,750 to stay in a quarantine hotel and just stay in the Holiday Inn Express Hounslow or wherever it is for 2 weeks. And obviously almost no one is going to, is going to put up with that amount of disruption, just for 10 days away in the sun. And then the third level is uncertainty. We saw during the summer where, where green routes were established, but then were, taken away at 24 or 48 hours notice. And here in Europe, you then had the scenes of, of people scrambling to to get back to their home country before quarantines hit. So those are the three stages, I would say, that that are stopping any kind of semblance of normality at the moment.
Yeah. So we'll talk about your new white paper, which is called Restarting Travel in 2021. And there's a couple of points that I picked out that I thought were quite interesting. One of them obviously goes back to what you've just been saying. And you mentioned in there that the challenge that air travel is facing is being perceived as a spreader of disease. Right. Now, particularly here in Southeast Asia, we've had borders closed for a year, pretty much, actually over a year. And the reason for that was that governments closed the borders because they decided that international cross-border travel was the primary vector of transmission. And so the issue for air travel is overcoming that, because governments have actually said we have to close down because air travel can cause transmission. Actually, then deleveraging that is almost impossible.
Well, and I think that there's no point fighting against it, because that should be self-evident. Travel spreads disease, or to be more accurate, mobility spreads disease. It's been like that since throughout human history. If you go back to the Middle Ages, the various plagues and the Black Death was spread by ship. So it's just a fact that that this is how disease spreads. That's something that we can't control. What we can control is how we react towards it. We've all, as we were saying before, we've all learned a lot over the past year. And there are, I believe, ways in which some kind of travel can resume, but of course, with a lot more friction than there was previously. Through a mix of, obviously biosafety measures, through a fairly rigorous testing program, and finally through effective track and trace and exposure notifications.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. We're at this sort of point now where 2020 was basically a lost year, and there was this hope that vaccines were coming, that vaccines would be the panacea to everything, but it hasn't quite worked out like that. So at the moment, because we have just these variable rates of vaccine rollouts, now how is travel actually going to reopen? It looks like there'll be different models around the world, or do you think that vaccine passports will enable a more sort of integrated approach to reopening borders?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that it's going to happen is that green routes will be established one by one, and that very we'll slowly have this patchwork of routes that will build up into a travel network again. I think it's unrealistic to say that that on the 1st of July, the 1st of August, and the 1st of October, or wherever it is, that there's suddenly going to be a great reopening. Countries are going to reopen at different speeds. And it will all depend on, first of all, community transmission, and secondly, on the, on the vaccine uptake in different countries. Now, in terms of health passports or vaccine passports, whatever we want to call them, they are inevitable. I mean, I was reading a Newsweek article last week, which said that you know, where they, some researchers went onto the dark web and you know, managed to find, I think it was 36 different vendors of people selling fake vaccination certificates at around $200. And of course, that was also a problem with testing. You know, in 2020, you had a lot of cases of fake test certificates being being sold. And it, clearly, the only way around that is to have some kind of, you know, secure digital credential that shows that, you know, that what you got is actually what you got, and it's proven.
And there are, I mean, there are numerous issues, as you mentioned, surrounding vaccination passports, particularly the actual capture of the information, the distribution, the sharing of that information. But right. From an airline standpoint, you know, what is it that concerns them most, and what is it they're trying to push to get these through the gate?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when it comes to health passports, and there are two different debates going on in society right now. I mean, first of all, the one that, you know, I'm not really sort of you know, able to comment on that much is for domestic use, you know, so sort of for, you know, for restaurants or sports venues or exhibition halls or, you know, whatever it is. And there I do understand that, you know, that there is a certain amount of pushback from people who have privacy concerns. But in terms of airlines, as I said, it's inevitable. And of course, you know, I mean, there's a certain amount of, you know, bureaucracy and paperwork and information sharing that's involved in cross-border travel anyway. I guess it's sort of one of the main factors from an aviation point is that the, you know, the idea of interoperability. I mean, we spoke to, I remember speaking to one American carrier back in September. And at that time, they said that they'd already been approached by 40 different health passport providers. And of course, right now, there are a lot more. So, you know, it's not realistic for someone to have, you know, four, five, six different health passports on his or her phone, which is why I personally think that the IATA travel pass, because of simply who they are and because of the, you know, because of the wide uptake on airlines and everyone from, you know, from Singapore Airlines to Rwanda Air to Copa, you know, trialing it at the moment, is the one that, you know, I think is most likely to become a, you know, a de facto standard for the aviation industry.
Yeah. One of the issues that we're starting to see here in Southeast Asia a little bit, I don't know if it's happening in Europe, is that there are a number of private vaccine initiatives, and the government seem to be actually encouraging these because the actual rollout of vaccines from government sources is quite slow because the actual supply of procuring vaccines is quite slow. So there is this kind of hope that if we have private vaccines, particularly for large companies, that kind of thing, that will actually complement the official rollout and therefore expedite the acceleration. But I guess there's going to be issues there about actually incorporating all that information together into a health passport.
But by private vaccine providers, you mean like private healthcare?
Yeah, so private healthcare or even companies actually able, or private providers are going to be providing these to companies. It's unclear at the moment. This is one of the issues that there seems to be no actual guidelines or frameworks for it. So in Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, we have these different kind of processes that are going on. And obviously people wanting to get vaccinated and prepared to pay for it, but actually capturing and using that information is going to be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And that also sort of leads on to the sort of this whole business of, you know, of vaccine tourism, which there is a little bit of that at the moment. I mean, I'm, you know, sort of, you probably saw the coverage earlier in the year about one club for the super rich called the Knightsbridge Circle was offering, I think it was trips to Dubai, which they were pricing at $40,000, or the membership was $40,000. And of course, as it was either the Sinopharm or the AstraZeneca vaccine, you know, they're given, you know, 3 weeks minimum apart, which means you have to, you know, fly to Dubai, stay in the villa for 3 weeks, and then, you know, and then get your second shot. But that also, you know, sort of links to the fact that, you know, if I'm a UK citizen and if I'm flying to the UAE and I'm getting my vaccine there from a private hospital, you know, how is that data stored? You know, how do I get a vaccine credential on the back of it? So I think that's a very good point.
Yeah. And also, as you said earlier, you know, quarantine is the big issue, not just for the outbound, but also in many cases, the return back to your home country or to wherever you reside. There doesn't seem to be any clarity about how vaccines will either reduce or even eliminate the quarantine requirement.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's sort of that one of the things we've learned over the past year is that, you know, governments will err on the side of caution. And that secondly is that, unfortunately for us, travel will be the last sector to reopen. You know, so obviously that sort of the retail and the entertainment space will come before travel, because you know, because there is this perception that travel is not needed, whereas of course retail is. You know, is how it is perceived. And you know, even though there is evidence so far that the vaccines do stop transmission, of course now the next sort of debate you're getting is that, well, you know, what if, you know, variant X, Y, or Z from, you know, from whatever country comes in and you know, and stops the vaccination program, and so we can't loosen up. And that seems to be the sort of the next you know, the next spanner in the works, as it were.
Going back to something that you said earlier, you were talking about green zones and green corridors. And in your white paper, you mentioned that there's a 50-50 trigger to establish green corridors. Can you tell us a little bit more about that concept and how it would work?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously we had to think of a sort of a trigger for a green zone to be established. And the two criteria would seem to be a combination of low community transmission, high vaccination uptake. And the 50-50 stands for, you know, lower than 50 new cases in 100,000, and over 50% of the adult population being vaccinated. Now, the under 50 in 100,000 is actually the CDC definition of a medium risk country, of which I think about sort of 20-25 countries at the moment, according to the CDC, you know, follow under that definition. And obviously, 50% of the population being vaccinated is self-explanatory. And you'd think that once you hit that level, and there are, you know, as of today, there are probably very, very few routes that sort of that match that criteria. But you would hope that sort of that certainly 3 months down the line, that a lot more you know, would fit into that. And that was really just sort of to, you know, sort of to get the debate going about what the trigger for a green route should be. And that's why we came up with this idea of sort of a 50-50. So it's at 50 and 100,000, and you know, and above 50% vaccinations.
So we've been running this podcast now since the end of 2019, and we really sort of kicked on in 2020. And obviously, that's when, you know, COVID-19 has just become the dominant theme ever since. Now, last summer, I remember we were talking here in Southeast Asia about the European reopenings, and the borders here were steadfastly closed, and they mostly remain steadfastly closed. But obviously, right, you had this sort of European fling where borders were reopened quite liberally last summer. I guess governments have learned their lesson a little bit, and obviously a lot of countries in Europe are going through a third wave or a fourth wave right now. You know, what do you think is the sort of prognosis for Europe over the next few months? Do you think there will be reopenings at all, or will it be on a green zone basis?
I think it'll be on a country by country basis. I mean, as of today, you know, I mean, France, for example, just went into a third or even a fourth lockdown. That was announced this evening for a 4 week period. You know, I mean, there's no appetite amongst European governments for travel between European countries. Now, obviously, you know, the likes of Greece and Cyprus, which are very you know, tourism dependent in terms of the economies, are keen to welcome tourists in, which is obviously why there's this talk about, you know, letting vaccinated British tourists travel to Cyprus and travel to Greece. But again, it has to work both ways, as we said. You know, for that to work, the UK government also then has to sort of to make sure that, you know, if I go to Cyprus for 2 weeks, that when I return, I'm not going to be in a quarantine hotel for 10 days afterwards. And yes, I mean, I think that governments are cautious. There's a lot of coverage, and there was a number of academic reports that were published following the European reopening of the summer of 2020 that showed that a lot of cases that, you know, that were there in you know, in October or November 2020, resulted because of people traveling, you know, because of people going on holidays. You know, I've seen a report in Ireland and also in the UK saying that the main spread in terms of the autumn came from people, for example, going to Spain. So from there, I mean, governments will be cautious, and we will see a sort of a more, you know, a more piecemeal reopening. I mean, certainly one of the things I've read here that might happen in the UK is of a traffic light system. You know, where there will be a, you know, sort of a, they're predicting a small number of green countries where you will just need an antigen test, so a lateral flow test when you come back, a certain number of amber countries where, you know, there might be a short quarantine and a PCR test, let's say on day zero and on day five. And then obviously red countries where there will be, you know, sort of full blown quarantine, which I guess may or may not be in a hotel as it is at the moment.
That leads sort of quite nicely into my next question. You're talking there about, you know, this sort of gradual, this phased opening. I think you mentioned in your white paper, you call it a staged reopening. So we're looking at the green zones, green corridors. It looks very similar here in Southeast Asia. Much of the reopenings that we're seeing are going to be country to country. So point-to-point flying is really what we're looking at for the foreseeable future. Now, we discussed a little bit about how this impacts airlines, but obviously this really impacts the big airports, the transit hubs like Singapore, Hong Kong, Dubai. So what kind of issues are they facing, and, you know, how can they recover in the short and the longer term?
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, they're facing a lot of issues in that the, you know, the large transit hubs, you will have, you know, people of different countries mixing where, you know, where there'll be hugely variable vaccination rates. So, you know, you may well have, you know, in Dubai, for example, you know, people from the UK, you know, which is obviously fairly, you know, far advanced in terms of vaccinations, mixing with, you know, people from, you know, a number of developing world countries where who haven't been vaccinated. And, you know, and it is a challenge, I guess, for, you know, for a major hub airport to sort of to manage that, you know, so that different mix of populations who've been vaccinated at different rates. And also, of course, with different vaccines. I mean, one of the things that's been talked about is this idea of a vaccine hierarchy. So, for example, if you're traveling to the United States, and one of the issues was sort of with vaccine passports, you would imagine that a US vaccine passport would, you know, would allow for vaccines that have been approved by the FDA, which at the moment is obviously it's only Moderna, Pfizer, BioNTech, and Johnson & Johnson. And, you know, and there's word of AstraZeneca applying for FDA approval. But that happened, you know, but that then the question is, what happens if you have someone who, you know, who's flying from the UAE with the Sinopharm vaccine, which is obviously one of the main vaccines being administered in Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, and flying to the States, and that person shows up, you know, in New York or San Francisco and what have you, with a vaccine that is not on the FDA list. So there's a lot of complexity, a lot of challenges that have to be met. And then also you have the, you know, sort of one of the problems that Dubai faced last year when the case happened, which I mentioned, where, you know, was sort of where 30 odd people turned up in Hong Kong on an Emirates flight who were COVID positive. From Dubai. Now, they didn't originate from Dubai. I believe that they originated in Pakistan, but they just passed through Dubai. And obviously, as a result of that and other cases, the UAE actually introduced, you know, having to be tested before departure, even if you're going through transit. So, you know, hubs like that will face a lot of complexity and a lot of challenges for, you know, certainly for the next 1, 2, maybe 3 years.
Yeah, you mentioned right at the beginning that, you know, aviation industries aren't alone in this, but we've learned so much over this last year about the way that economies work, the way that politics works, the way geopolitics works, all of these things. But the aviation industry has been hit particularly hard because it's been at the forefront of the transmission issues. So do you think that airlines have learned much? And do you think that they've used this or they will use this to sort of future-proof themselves against a second pandemic?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think to a certain extent. I mean, we at Simplifying talk about the three S's, which are going to be important moving forward, which is safety, sanitation, and sustainable business. Now, safety is obviously self-evident. It's always been there. Sanitation, you know, we now have the sort of the health theater, which is sort of which will sit alongside the, you know, sort of the safety and security theater, because, you know, people are really talking about the next pandemic, and this idea of sort of pandemics, it is not going away. It's been sort of, it's been such a sort of a life-changing event for almost everyone that it's seared into the public consciousness. And this is a reality that we will have to sort of to deal with going forward. And the third is sustainable business. That's actually attached to that. First of all, sustainability, so the environment. That was, of course, a major concern for the aviation industry before the pandemic. But that will come back. And not only that, I believe that the sort of the idea of pandemics and the environment will be merged together. I mean, you already had Dr. Mike Ryan of the WHO making that very, very same point, and making the point explicitly that in his view, that global warming and human encroachment on the environment makes zoonotic diseases more likely. And that, I think, will be a sort of a very powerful argument that environmental campaigners will be using in future and saying, well, a very good reason to sort of to put the brakes on global warming is we don't want another sort of COVID hitting us and for us to go through what we've just been through, but also sustainable businesses. I mean, if you remember that in March, April, certainly in the US, to a certain extent in the UK as well, there's a lot of controversy about airlines receiving bailouts and receiving government funds. And that was due in part to, to a certain amount of bad feeling amongst the traveling public about perceived standards slipping in terms of both customer service, in terms of comfort, and of course, a lot of bad publicity about, in the US, certain airlines using buyback stock options, eating through cash, and then, and then when times were bad, sort of looking for government funding. And so I think the sort of the spotlight will also be shone on, on how businesses operate going forward.
Now, I think our listeners would be quite interested to hear a little bit about the UK perspective, because you have zoomed ahead with, certainly with the first vaccine dose, second vaccines maybe a little bit slow, but we'll wait and see upon that. Mm-hmm. I think here in Asia at the moment, there is still, as you said there, there is still this kind of feeling of nobody quite knows what's happening, and that will obviously hit future demand and people's comfort and safety to travel again. What's your perception in the UK? Because vaccines have sort of zoomed ahead, do you feel that people will want to travel again as soon as they can?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially since a lot of people have, been able to travel for the last 12 months plus. And I think there's a real urge and a real yearning to sort of to return to some kind of normality. And, and other than the UK, obviously the country that's even furthest ahead is Israel. And I always look to Israel for examples of how things are moving. And there as well, you also see a lot of appetite for, for life to resume in terms of restaurants, in terms of entertainment, and also in terms of, in terms of travel. So I do see that picking up again. I see the demand picking up again. Of course, the key factor is whether the authorities will allow.
Absolutely, I would agree with that. So at the beginning of the show, you talked a little bit about your travel schedule pre-pandemic and the flights and journeys that you were supposed to make but couldn't make. When you are able to fly again, Dirk, where will you be going? Where's your first flight?
I had my first vaccine dose several weeks ago, and I have my second one in mid-May. I would hope to go to the United States in June. I'm actually a dual US-UK citizen, so even if the sort of travel restrictions in the US are in place, I can travel to the United States. But then obviously, as I said, the question is what happens when I come back, whether I have to quarantine or not, partially for for leisure, to sort of to go on vacation, but also because we have this this testing project in North America and working with with Mexican airlines. We're looking to expand into Canada and into the Caribbean for business purposes too.
Great. Well, Dirk, thanks very much for that. So that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed with Dirk or anything that we missed out. Please drop us a line at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or on Twitter at SEA Travel Show. Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show. That just gives me a chance to wrap up and say, Dirk, thank you very much for your insights. It's great. We'll put up some notes about your white papers, because the work that you've been doing is absolutely fantastic. Please keep it up. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asia travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Amazing. Thank you so much.